12. Borlioche. Commander Eldo Davip, captain of the Luzonkip, the greatest new Republic ship engaged in the defense of Borlioche, took the turbolift down to the Beltway. The Beltway was a central corridor running the length of the Superstar destroyer, from stern to prow. It was not a corridor for pedestrian traffic. The octagonal shaft featured a tracked hauler at the top, allowing it to be used for transportation of heavy equipment. It was wide enough that skilled pilots could have flown paired X-wings wing-to-wing along its length. As the turbolift slowed to a halt, he pulled on a pair of darkened goggles. When the lift doors opened, the precaution proved to be an appropriate one. Directly in front of him, mechanics were welding another section onto the apparatus that now filled the forward portions of the beltway, blocking all movement forward of this point. The outer shell of the apparatus was rolled metal, meters thick. Each section of the shell was 100 meters long, open at either end, with the prow end slightly narrower than the stern, allowing the sections to be installed in an overlapping fashion. The mechanics welded them together at the overlaps. Inside the shell were metal cables drawn in intricate weave-like patterns through hardy metal rings on the interior surface of the shells. The pattern of the cables, their carefully monitored tensions, was not only to keep the shell straight and durable along its length. As soon as they were in place, cargo box-sized containers were situated among them, tied off by more cables, instrument packages attached and carefully attuned. The apparatus now stretched a third of Luzonkia's length, hidden away in this access shaft. None of the Vong's extraordinary visual sensors could detect its fabrication. None of their strategists could anticipate its use. Davit sighed. Its use would mark the end of his most prestigious command. But prestige wouldn't mean a thing if the Yuuzhan Vong won. So he watched the continued manufacture of the apparatus and wished it well. On the planet below, on the second floor of the biotics building, Captain Yukon Reth set his dinner tray down at a table, allowing it to clatter, and sat heavily on the bench before it. He didn't bother to keep his disgruntlement from his face. Opposite, Lieutenant Distiwin, who flew in Reth's squadron as Black Moon II, smoothed down fur that had suddenly risen on his neck. A brown and gold furred Bothan. Dis was unusually attractive by both Bothan and human standards, and received an enviable amount of attention in social situations. "What crawled down your flight suit and stung your butt?" he asked. Reth snorted, amused despite himself. "We're in real trouble here on Borlioche." Tivin gaped at him. "Really? I thought we were winning." "Stop kidding. I mean in trouble worse than being outnumbered, besieged, and doomed." "Oh." Tivin speared a cooked slice of hearty local tin fruit and popped it into his mouth. "So, vent already." "Don't talk with your mouth full. No, Dis, this is no joke." He lowered his voice so his words would not carry to the next table. "I think we're in real trouble at the command level." "General Antilles? He has a great reputation." "Bear with me. You know who's commanding Luzonkia?" "Eldo Davip." "A first-rate foul-up, if ever there was one." "Granted, but he did do all right during the big Yuuzhan Vong push a few weeks back." "A fluke, I'm sure. Anyway, Nenora Beert escorted a shuttle out to Luzonkia's repair station. She said that repairs weren't going well. Whole banks of turbolasers and ion cannon batteries were still out of commission. I didn't think Luzonkia got that badly hammered in the last engagement, did you?"
"Not really."
"Which points to colossal mismanagement on Commander Davit's part, which General Antilles either doesn't know about or hasn't corrected, which doesn't speak well of his skills." Tivin shrugged, noncommittal, but he no longer looked as cheerful. "That's just the start. You remember when the Advisory Council visited?" "Very hush-hush. They had a meeting with Antilles and his general staff, then rushed off. A mechanic who's just been transferred to Black Moon Squadron was in the hallway when they left. He says Counselor Puel was furious. Puel was saying that Antilles had refused command of Borlias and only relented after making demands to the Council." "What demands?" I don't know. What demands would you make? Pleasure yacht, a lifetime pass to the errant venture? Reth eyed the sliced sausage swimming in spice sauce on his plate. That as much as this talk was going to cost him his appetite. Stop kidding around. And then there's this Jaina Solo thing. Tubin nodded in agreement. If we have to circle one more time just because her squadron always gets first clearance to land. She and her pilots are getting special treatment in every category there is. First access to spare parts, first access to BACTA for proton torpedo loads, first repairs to starfighters and astromechs. Have you ever seen one of them eating here? Reth gestured around at the rest of the mess hall, crammed with tables ringing with noise. No. They have their own lounge, and rumor says they have their own chef off Rebel Dream. Her mother's old ship. Her mother's old ship. Twin's Sons hasn't done anything. Black Moon Squadron hasn't. And can't do anything we can't, except show off names of important mommies and daddies. Keep it calm, Yak. There have got to be political reasons behind this. With politics, nothing runs right. But without politics, nothing runs. Reth nodded grudging agreement. It just keeps piling up, and I have to question Antilles' competence. Keep it down, will you? You're starting to sound like a mutineer in training. Reth flashed his second-in-command a broad grin. Nothing like that. I'm just trying to figure out whether I should put in for a transfer, try to get in with a squadron in one of the other fleet groups. I'm not sure what to do yet. If you hear anything along the lines of what I've been saying, well, you'll just keep your ears open, won't you? Tubin waggled his pointed, oversized Bothan ears. Always do. Transport ship Fu'ulang, Coruscant orbit. Wrapped in the concealing folds of her cloakskin, willing her shaper's headdress to remain still so as not to give away her caste to observers, the shaper, Nen Yim, followed the warmaster, Tsavan La, out onto the Ganadot tongue. Ganadotes were immobile creatures, born as a flat, long shell about 5 paces long and wide, and a pace high. They were little more than a mouth, an anus, a large canal connecting them, as well as opening into side stomach chambers, and a tongue. But when grown to maturity and trained in their master's wishes, they made magnificent entryways and viewing boxes. Kept fed by servants bringing clip beetle shells and other nutritious waste, and dropping those foods straight through their stomach valves, shaped by hormones to change their dimensions, ganadotes could be transformed into domed or spherical vestibules. The tissues that lined their intestinal tracts were beautifully iridescent, and a proper diet kept excretion to a rare event. But it was the tongue that made the ganadote such a charming architectural feature. One trained in its use could step out onto it and, by leaning or toe pressure, cause it to extend, lower, raise, position its tip anywhere in relation to the creature's body. And that was what Tsavan La did. Once Nen Yim was in place, he coaxed the ganadote tongue out over the large chamber at the heart of his living ship, over the crowd, short of the fibrous leaves that blocked off the far exit from the chamber. Tsavan La threw up his hands, tossing his cloak back over his shoulders. Priests and shapers, devotees of the great god Yung Yuzhan, I salute and welcome you. Soon you will be taken from this place to nearby Borlios, where my sire, Shul Kong La, drives the infidels into dejection and defeat. The listeners, perhaps 30, castes evenly divided between shapers and priests of Yun Yuzhong, raised their voices in noises of celebration, appreciation. Nen Yim could make out the faces of many, including the shaper Githra Dal, whom she had accused, and Takhof Ul, the priest who had been in Githra Dal's constant, if surreptitious, company these last many weeks. "As you know," Tsavan La said, "you travel there to take possession of Borlios once it falls. That green, rich world, almost free of the touch of the infidel, will be your reward for service to the gods, service to the Yuzhan Vong. Half will be the domain of the priests, half of the shapers, all united in the worship of Yun Yuzhan. All you need to do to claim it is raise your mighty temples, your gloriously crafted domains, upon her. Sadly, you will fail to do this. And there it was, the start of the War Master's revenge, expressed in a handful of calmly expressed words. The crowd quieted, with many of its members turning to one another, muttering questions. I look forward to waking each day without being assailed by the smell of sickness, the odor of the decay of my own arm. I look forward to rising each morning in the sure knowledge that I have not displeased the gods. Only a few rogue priests and shapers who dared to misappropriate the gods' will. Savang La's voice turned thunderous, and Nen Yim saw his broad back shake with the emotion of his words. I look forward to knowing that those who remain behind are united in their hatred of the infidels, not in their greed for what they may obtain at the expense of others. I rejoice to think that you will soon be gone. No, War Master. That was the voice of the priest, Takaf Ul, young for his posting, ambitious beyond his years. There has been no such treachery. You must not think it. Only in the true service to Yun Yuzhan can you save your arm, save yourself from the company of the shamed ones. There are some who say that trust is a matter of faith, Savang La replied. I say that trust is a matter of knowledge, of observation. Find one who is trustworthy, and there is trust. Find one who is not, and there is none. But I will give you a chance at life. Takaf Ul, do you trust our gods? The youthful priest cried up to him, I do, War Master. Do they trust you? What? I don't understand. If they trust you, trust that your motives have been true, trust that you have thought only of their honor and not your own, I am certain they will save you from this. He raised his rawdank claw arm, pointing its pincer at the enormous leaves covering the chamber's far entryway. That was Nen Yim's cue. Beneath her robe she stroked a tiny kin to that enormous plant, coaxing it to act. It did. It curled into a tube. So did the ones in the distance, revealing a dark gap in the wall beyond. The gap was four times the height of a Yuzhan Vong warrior, four times as wide. A snuffling noise emerged from the gap. Then something like a low, muted roar. Then something emerged. Like a Yuzhan Vong, it had two arms, two legs, but its stance was low, crouching, animalistic. It had tremendous muscles, hard and corded enough to support its tremendous weight, for it was as tall as the gap through which it emerged. Its face was tusked, its teeth were huge, and its head swiveled as it spotted the Yuzhan Vong on the chamber floor. Its eyes followed these small creatures with the avidity of a hungry beast. This is a rancor, Savan Law said. A beast of this galaxy. You do not deserve honorable death at the hands of one of your own living weapons. When you die here, it will not be as fighters, but as food to sate the creature's appetite. What if we kill it? That was the voice of Githra Dahl, filled with spite. Then you live for a while longer, said the War Master. A short while. Through the gap emerged another rancor, then a third, and a fourth. They spread out from the gap, moving along the walls of the chamber, circling their tiny prey. Savang La leaned back, and the tongue retracted, carrying him and Nen Yim into the Ganadote mouth. As the first screams began, as the first roars echoed from the chamber walls, they turned away from the feasting scene below, and the War Master led the shaper out through the back way. War Master, may I ask two questions? You may. They emerged from the Ganadote into a large blood-blue corridor, and were joined by Tsavong Law's personal guards, who marched a respectful distance ahead of and behind them. First, will there be no outcry from the priesthood of Yun Yuzhan, from the shapers? An outcry? Of course there will be. A cry for blood. When word returns to us that their transport was attacked by pilots of Borlias, all its passengers slaughtered, there will be a great cry for revenge.
Ah.
Ninyam walked along in silence for a moment, knowing that his reply had spelled her doom, too. Should I not go with them, or is my death to be a different one? I can't kill you. You're on loan from Overlord Shimra. Besides, I have no reason to wish you harm. They entered the stomach compartment that now housed Savang La's private transport. The eyelid-like wall on the far side was closed now, keeping the chamber's atmosphere intact. They walked to the transport's ramp-like protrusion and climbed into the creature's passenger stomach. "I am pleased with you, Ninyam. Do you plan to tell this story, to rouse hatred against me?"
"No."
"If you did, what would happen?" She thought about that as she settled into her seat. Its fleshy surface flowed around her waist, her torso, holding her in place against the acceleration to come. "The only reason to do so would be to harm you, in which case it becomes the story of a discredited shaper against that of the War Master, and I would die before I could present proof." "And such a waste. Your cleverness, used in our service, more than makes up for the loss of Githradal and his conspirators. Will you use it in our service?"
"I will."
She did not hesitate. Savang La said, "our service." To her, that meant to Yuuzhan Vong, not him personally. And she could swear to that with a whole heart. "Some day soon, the seed ship will return to this world and complete its transformation. I wish you to return to Lord Shimra and study the world brain. I wish you to do nothing to displease the gods, but to find that knowledge which the gods do not mind us knowing."
"I will, War Master."
"Then speak no more of your death. It will come when the time is appropriate. It is not appropriate now." Coruscant. Baljos Arnjak was beginning to look like he, too, was being Vong-formed. His beard and mustache were growing in, shaggy, and in colors that ranged from light brown to black. His beard seemed like a riotous life-form not native to this world. The orange jumpsuit he wore when not traveling in Yuuzhan Vong armor seemed to have many more stains on it now, and some of them might have been living patches of mold or lichen. But these changes and the group's circumstances seemed to be sitting well with him. His eyes were bright, his manner animated. "Come in, come in," he said, waving the Jedi and Danny into the Lord Nyack's suspended animation chamber. Bindi was already there, perched on a stool. "Tell me you have some information," Luke said. Baljos beamed. "I have some information. There, that was painless, wasn't it? You can all go now." "Don't taunt the Jedi," Bindi said. "And don't take credit you don't deserve. I'm the one who dug most of the information out of the wrecked guts of those maintenance machines." "True enough, circuitry girl. Not that you could have interpreted—" Baljos doubtless saw the impatience in someone's face, probably Tahiri's, for he broke off that line of talk. "We're prepared to tell you whatever you need to know about Lord Nyack. Anything Bindi didn't find in the machine memory, we'll just make up." Luke leaned against a wrecked computer console and crossed his arms as though to put up a defense against whatever information was to come. "So who is he? What was he modified for?" Baljos nodded as though that was the first pair of questions he'd expected. "He is, or used to be, a dark Jedi. His name was Irek Ismaran." Luke frowned, then shook his head. "No, that's not possible." "Who's Irek Ismaran?" Tahiri asked. Luke dug his data pad out of a belt pouch. "Like Baljos said, he was a dark Jedi in training. A son either of the Emperor or of one Sarsev Quest by a woman named Roganda Ismaran. She was a crazy woman who modified her son with computer implants. My sister Leia ran into him on Belsavis, about 15 years ago." He opened the datapad and began scrolling through entries, though nowhere near as comprehensive as the database he kept in whatever hidden site might serve as the Jedi headquarters. This datapad included an abbreviated listing on every Jedi, Sith, Force-sensitive or Force-related person or site he had ever encountered in his long searches for knowledge of the Jedi Order. Within moments, he found the file he wanted. A face resolved into clarity on the datapad screen. Aristocratic, handsome, somehow unfinished in a teenaged way, framed by curly dark hair, it was the face of a younger Lord Nyax. Suddenly, Luke felt as pale as Lord Nyax. He showed the image to Mara. She nodded. She noted some of the details that appeared on the screen under Irek's name. So he should be about 30 now. Yes, and of normal height. Except, Baljus interrupted, he spent most of the intervening years in that suspended animation chamber, so he is physically younger than his chronological age. His vital processes were slowed. He was subjected to the medical treatments I mentioned earlier, treatments that kept his bones growing long past the point they should have sealed, that gave him lots more muscle mass. As a baby, he'd had a computer apparatus implanted in his brain by his mother. It helped give him enough focus, monomania may be a better word for it, to learn to control the Force far out of proportion to his age. When he was here, that apparatus was augmented to make his control even greater. It apparently stimulates what's left of his brain in ways beneficial to Force control. He was equipped with lightsaber weapons, their use part of the hard coding in his brain implant. Luke snapped the datapad shut. How did this happen? Bindi said, It appears that after leaving Belsavis, he and his mother came to Coruscant and hid here, and by here I mean in this very facility. His mother carefully monitored his progress in the Force, training him so that he'd be the most powerful dark Jedi in existence, and gave him medical treatments to make him much bigger, more imposing, more physically powerful. She also arranged to bring in the Issa Lemiri to keep him hidden as his presence in the Force grew stronger. Then something happened, Baljus said. The notes are not exactly clear, but it seems like they found and took on a partner, another dark Jedi, and at some point Irek and the new partner got in a dispute and dueled. The partner was killed, and Irek took a lightsaber thrust right through the skull. He died. Died, Luke said. Technically died, Baljus added. Brain activity ceased. He fell down and didn't move anymore. But his mother and the attendant medical droids were able to maintain his autonomic functions and keep his body alive. Her journal, not surprisingly, gets a bit harder to understand at this point and becomes increasingly demented over the years, but it becomes obvious that she kept his body in suspended animation and had the medical droids insert increasingly sophisticated components into the computer apparatus in his skull. Luke grimaced. With what purpose? I think, Baljus said, that she was trying to make him into her son again. An unlikely prospect, since most of the portions of the brain that pertain to memory and the less violent emotions were charred into carbon, and also to make him into a new leader for the Empire. She was just crazy enough to imagine he could be Emperor Irek, loving son, dark Jedi, and unconquerable tyrant. Luke exchanged a look with Mara. She didn't let any of her emotions reach her face, but he could feel them through the Force. A revulsion for a woman mad enough to keep her own son on the butcher's block like that for so many years. "What happened to Roganda Ismaran?" he asked. "She was the female corpse we found here. We ran cell samples against her records in the files. There's no mistake." Luke gave him a disbelieving look. Irek killed her? He's not Irek anymore. Lord Nyax killed her. He didn't recognize her. She was just another moving shape in the way when he broke out of his holding tank. Baljus shook his head. Very nasty business. It gives even mad science a bad name. Does he have any weaknesses? Mara asked. Oh, yes. Baljus gestured at the suspended animation unit. He's not ripe. Ripe? Luke repeated. It appears that a ground quake caused some ceiling rubble to drop onto one or more of the Isolamiri, killing them and damaging the unit. He woke up, burst out, went on a rampage, and fled. But he wasn't due to come out for another couple of years. Alsos pointed at one of the computer consoles. All his operational programming was there, plus the refabricated IREC memories Rogonda planned to implant in him, and they weren't transferred over. He has his instincts, he has some combat programming, and he has some deep-level motivations, such as to seek out Jedi and kill them, to seek out hot points of the Force and control them, to conquer the universe, little things like that. But he lacks memories, tactical skills, even language, I think. I doubt he's even verbal. So we can't even talk to him. Tahiri looked downcast. Maybe that's a weakness, but it doesn't make things easier on us. He can't be reasoned with. I guess that leaves me with only one more question. Luke returned the datapad to his belt pouch and prepared himself for what he expected to be more bad news. Is there any way to save him, to befriend him, teach him about the light side? Boswell finally became serious. I don't think so. He's had almost all humanity burned out of his brain. He's just a predator whose only goal is to dominate. Great, Luke said. Vicky spent almost her every hour in the chamber that concealed the ugly truth. Though not technically proficient, she knew enough about machinery and could glean more from the ship's computer memory to have a good sense of the resources available to her here. Ugly Truth was definitely capable of spaceflight, and her inboard diagnostics indicated that every ship's system was undamaged, operational. The ship was fully fueled, and battery power for starting up systems and even providing her with some discretionary lights and occasional cool air was adequate to last for weeks more. The problem was the exit chute. It had collapsed during Coruscant's fall or subsequent bombardment. Small chunks of duracrete and ferrocrete had fallen, then metal beams had twisted, and more rubble had fallen onto the beams, the whole mass crushing into an impenetrable plug. Floors above the hidden hangar, she'd found a hole providing access into the exit chute above the plug. Here there were signs that someone had been working, digging away at the plug from above, hauling blocks of duracrete into an office chamber at that level. She supposed that the worker had been the pretty boy who'd given her the locator. She'd even found the boy's name. In the ship's computer records was information about the family that had owned the Ugly Truth. Hassville and Adre Terson had been the founders of Terson Comfort Carriers, an air taxi company. Vicky had seen the ubiquitous vehicles of their fleet, even ridden within them during her secret activities aiding the Yuuzhan Vong. The ship's records included a holo of their son, Hasray, the boy with the remote. Another little sad story, she decided. She pondered that for a while. She couldn't feel the sadness of it. Far from it, she was elated that the boy's sacrifice meant her salvation. Vicky spent most of her time studying the ship's controls and diagrams, digging into the ship's stores of food, regaining her strength. Occasionally she had to venture forth, very quietly, very carefully, to work on unplugging the exit chute or to find the chamber down the hall on this floor she had chosen for a refresher. This day she emerged from the refresher and peered up and down the corridor with her customary caution. There was no sound, no sign of movement. Slowly, carefully, she headed back toward the Terson family quarters. Something wrapped around her neck from behind jerked her off her feet. She landed on her back, choking, and stared up into the features of Danua Ku. The warrior held his amphistaff in one hand. The other end of the weapon was coiled around Vicky's neck. She gaped up at him. He was dead. She knew he was dead. He'd died back in the furniture manufacturers, but now he stared down at her, helmet off, eyes neither angry nor solicitous. Get up, he said. She struggled to her feet, assuming control over her expression, her manner, her breathing. As she rose, the amphistaff's tail slid from around her. "Danua Ku," she said. "I'd thought you had died." I ran. The warrior's voice sounded bitter. My duty dictated that I return to my commander and describe what I'd seen, the giant Jedi. Now that my superiors are informed, I can return to confront the monstrous thing and kill it or be killed by it. Why did you not seek out the Yuuzhan Vong and tell them what had happened? She let some scorn creep into her tone. A human, alone, wandering about the rooftops, waving down coral skippers. Do you know what happens to them? I do. I was shot at twice. That was a lie. She'd never ventured to the rooftops. But she'd seen the skips on patrol, seen how they fired at anything that might be an inhabitant of the planet caught above ground. So you came here? Why? I knew the people who lived here. This lie came smoothly to her, too. Hassville and Audrey Terson and their boy Hasray. They were wealthy. I knew their quarters would have preserved food hidden in them, and I was right. I knew that would give me time to figure out how to return to the worldship without getting myself killed. How did you find me? He reached under his armor at the armpit and pulled forth a creature, an insect about the size of one of Vicky's fingernails. It looked like some sort of beetle, but was the red color of arterial blood. Though its wings were folded along its back, perfectly shaped to its carapace, they vibrated, causing the little creature to buzz constantly. "This is a Nisbat," the warrior said. "When it is near any of its hatchmates, it makes this noise, increasing in volume as it gets closer." "So? So one of its hatchmates is within you?" Vicky couldn't keep her eyes from widening. "Something that size is inside me?" "No, it was implanted in you when it was fresh hatched. It cannot grow. It cannot even vibrate. But it can be felt by its fellows." "I am grateful to it that it has allowed you to find me." "Hmm." The new Akus acknowledgment sounded neither accepting nor dubious. "Now you will be able to return to the worldship." "I am delighted." "After we find and kill the giant Jedi." Vicky's heart sank. She kept it from her face. "Shall I hold him down while you kill him?" The new Aku's lips twitched up in a smile. "Amusing. Is that as funny and basic as it is in our tongue?" "If our two cultures share anything, it is irony." The warrior held up a hand. From other doorways in the corridor emerged more warriors, a party of 24 or more, Vicky calculated, and with them was another Voxen. This one was worse off than the previous one. It was a sickly yellow almost everywhere, and in places its scales were flaking off completely. Its head hung listlessly, and it did not even bother to snap at the warrior nearest it. "Ah," Vicky forced a smile, "even better. Come along." The new Aku led the way toward the nearest emergency stairwell. Vicky followed, her smile fixed, her mind racing. She would find a way to elude them. She would pry the Nisbat from her body, wherever it was hidden. She still had her locator tucked away, and the stairwell to the ugly truth was closed, hidden. She would be able to return here. She would clear that exit chute and blast off to safety. And if it were humanly possible, she would see Danu Aku dead first, dead for daring to force her back into his plans when her plans were so much more important. She kept her back straight and her manner haughty. No matter whom she aided, no matter what she wore, she was of the royal lines of Kuat.